I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books on political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Joshua Foa-Dienstog, professor of political science at UCLA, about his 2020 book, Cinema Pessimism, A Political Theory of Representation and Reciprocity, from Oxford University Press. Dienstog works on modern European political theory from the 17th through the 19th centuries, as well as political theory and film. He is the author of many articles and several books, including Pessimism, Philosophy, Ethic, and Spirit in 2006.
First of all, let me say, Joshua Dienstog, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Joshua, this was a great book. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a really careful and illuminating reading of some great films that I love, lots of people love, which you apply to democratic theory in surprising and really interesting ways. So well done.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you first, which I do always to start off, ask you about the motivation for writing the book. You've been working on film and democratic theory and pessimism now for several years. So why did this book crystallize those different themes into one in this form?
Yes, I had sort of two motivations, one kind of methodological and another more political. On the methodological side, people have been writing about film and political theory for a long time, but I had the idea that we haven't really kind of explored what film can really do for us as political theorists. And, people often write about film as if it's like an illustration of some theory, like, here, look at this Western, isn't this like the state of nature? But in a sense, I thought that isn't taking film seriously enough as something that actually might be equivalent to, a real work of political theory. And so I wanted to see how film could actually not just illustrate questions, but actually maybe answer them or provide answers of a kind that we can't always get from books. But then more importantly, really, was the whole question of representation in democracy, what we want representation to do in democracy, and the crisis of representation in democracy, that is the populism which has appeared in this country and many others, that is sort of dissatisfaction with representative institutions. In the US, in England, in the European Union, you have people in Brazil, populations that seem to be very unhappy with their representative institutions. And at the same time, you have a lot of democratic theory, political theory, that celebrates representation, that tells us that representation is the best kind of democracy, even, better than Athenian democracy. So I feel like there's sort of practically a great disconnect between what democratic theorists are saying about representation right now in the last, 10, 20 years, and what democratic populations are doing about representation right now, that is sort of rebelling against it, or at least complaining about it in very strident terms. And I wondered why that is. And I thought that in film, we can sort of see some of the reasons that representation ends up being frustrating, even though it's meant to serve a democratic purpose.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was wondering about the timeline of the writing of this book. So did you think about the critiques of representation with the sort of populist backlash in the background? That is, that the sort of the films that you discuss. More general, I guess.
I came to it sort of step by step. I mean, first I started writing about most of the chapters started out as individual papers, and at first I was just writing individual papers about Blade Runner and then about Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and I was asking myself what can we learn from this individual film. But after I wrote a couple of these, I sort of realize that I was returning over and over again to the general question of representation and, how we interact with our representatives and how we think about living in a world with a lot of representation. And so I, then when I was thinking about how to put these together, it became clear that representation was the general theme and the general problem. And then as I was doing all that, that was sort of right during the 2016 election, as, we were going through this attack on our democratic representative system and the fact that we learned that a great number of people are indeed deeply unhappy with our representative institutions, even though in some sense our representative institutions function about as well as they ever have, right? Our representatives today are incredibly well informed about what people want. You know, they're not out of touch in the ways that they might have been 100 years ago, when it was hard to know what all your constituents thought and it was hard to keep in touch with them. It's not hard now at all. You can be in touch with your representative, in moments. You can send them an email or a text or anything. And our representatives are constantly, polling us and emailing us and trying to stay in touch, desperate to stay in touch with us, in fact. So in some sense, there's, more communication than ever before between elected representatives and their constituents. And yet people are, at least some people are super unhappy with the whole democratic arrangement, the whole democratic representative arrangement.
Right. Congress, for example, has one of the lowest approval ratings, on record.
Yes,
right? It is absolutely a puzzle, as you say. It's Congress people to seem to be hardworking people by and large and really care about their jobs, but yet the American people, despite a great economy, tend more and more mistrust representatives.
And I mean, the representatives themselves are probably personally much less corrupt than they were in the 18th and 19th century. But that doesn't stop people from being very unhappy. So I began to think that there's something sort of frustrating in the representative relationship itself, something that's sort of unavoidable about frustration within representation. So the book attempts to sort of identify that and come to terms with it. And I do think there is something fundamentally frustrating that representation, although it, kind of holds itself out as a substitute for more direct human experiences, isn't a substitute or isn't a perfect one. And so people are bound to be frustrated by their relationship with their representative, but we can come to terms with that, but we have to sort of acknowledge what the problem is.
Right. Good. And this is helpful, I think, maybe a point to talk about the pessimism side of things, because your view is not that, here are some problems with representative government and, if we could just fix them, then representative government would be great. You develop this, the pessimistic view that you've developed in your previous work, namely that there's something sort of inherently contradictory or inherently problematic about representation itself, so that we can't, even if we figure out all the problems, we can't fix them. We won't be able to develop a perfect system. So maybe you can say a little bit about the pessimistic groundwork and background for this.
Sure. Right. So my previous book on pessimism is just about sort of the inherent difficulties in life in general and politics, and the way sort of optimism, the way we're trained to believe that there is a perfect solution to our problems, that our frustrations are all temporary, and that there is a place we could get to where we could be free and happy at the same time. And one of the arguments of that book is that freedom and happiness are in a certain kind of tension with one another. And the things that make us happy and the things that make us free aren't necessarily the same, so that if we want to live free lives, we have to tolerate a certain degree of unhappiness. This book attempts to, I guess, concretize that in a way by talking more specifically about the tensions between freedom and happiness that arise in the representative situation, where the things that make us happy are also things that kind of deprive us of the conditions of freedom. In the same way that, you know, a film can make us happy, but it's not a very active experience. It's a very passive experience where, you know, we're sitting there kind of imagining that we're engaging emotionally or physically with a situation or a person that's being depicted for us on a film. But, you know, we're not actually having that experience. We're having a kind of simulation of that experience. And, you know, it may feel to us in the moment that, like, we're doing something, but, you know, when the movie's over, we realize we haven't really done anything at all. We haven't really had a relationship with the person at all. We've just had a kind of simulation of it. But, you know, that doesn't mean representation is always a bad thing. It has a lot of important purposes, but it's not a substitute for more authentic elements of human life.
Right. What I find really useful about your analysis is sort of the helpful reminder of the inherent tension in all of our concepts or all of our thinking, particularly in representation, and that these are tensions that are unavoidable, that are unavoidable trade-offs, that we can't develop a sort of perfect representative system or perfect, you know, mimetic artwork or something that perfectly captures all of reality. But there's always some trade-off that's going on.
Well, I think this is sort of characteristic of the pessimistic tradition. What pessimists are constantly pointing out about optimists, Hobbes or Hegel, who each in their own way, Hobbes and Hegel, believe there is a perfectly rational political system, even if it's hard to construct, even if it's, you know, off in the future a ways, a system built entirely on reason, which will perfectly satisfy human desires, and perfectly transmit and arbitrate between conflicts. For the pessimists, like Rousseau, like Nietzsche, who are some of the people I focus on in the pessimism book, there's always a difficulty in getting human beings to live with one another. And those difficulties are something that you can manage, but they're not something that you can get rid of. And especially for Rousseau, and, you know, a lot of this book on cinema is kind of as one of the people who wrote a blurb on the back for it said, it's kind of an updating of Rousseau's critique of theater. And that's quite right. Rousseau thought that there was no place for the theater in a republic. Because there was an inherent tension between the representation that goes on in the theater and the democratic citizenship that we need to perform to sustain life in an active democracy. And I think that same kind of tension exists between life we experience in the movies or on our screens more generally, and what we have to do to be active citizens. Doesn't mean we have to burn the theaters to the ground, but we have to understand that, you know, the pleasures that we get from representation are not always healthy for us as citizens.
Right. And the films you choose are very much part of that pessimistic tradition. Just to sort of let everybody know what the films are, the film Her, Blade Runner, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, a few Lars von Trier movies, Europa and Melancholia, and the Michael Apted Up documentary film series. So it's a really diverse group of films, but really sort of fit nicely within this pessimistic tradition. And also I find quite interesting your analysis, the way in which all those films are self-reflexive about the nature of cinematic representation. So maybe you could say a little bit just about sort of the choice of films, how you came to this group of films. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've already said the crucial thing, which is that all the films in some sense are reflexive or self-reflexive about they're all interesting stories, but they're also films about the process of representation. And in some sense, some of them anyway, are films that are about the dangers of representation. I'd say especially Her and Blade Runner are films that, kind of tell us about the limitations of film or about the limitations of, a mediated existence. That is an existence in which, we're constantly dealing with intermediaries rather than having real human relationships with other people. So, the films are all kind of meant to reflect, the films do reflect on either living in a representative, a highly representative world, a highly representative condition, or there are films that reflect on, how to improve that. And I think you mentioned them in order. The first is Her, Blade Runner, then Liberty Valance, and the Lars von Trier chapter. And then finally, the chapter about the Up films, the series of documentaries, 7 Up, 21 Up, 49 Up, that are about the same group of people in England over 50 years. And that's that final chapter is meant to point the way to a better kind of relationship with representation. It's a documentary film. It's not fiction. And it's a documentary, though, constantly reflects on what it means to actually depict a person or a group of people, have them be dissatisfied with that representation, and yet keep attempting to get it better, get it right, so that over the course of, it's now 7, 8, or 9 films and 50 years, you do get a quite wonderful and detailed account of the individuals who are depicted. So anyway, the films don't represent, they're not all Westerns or all science fiction or all love stories or something like that, but they are all films that are about representation and its problems. And hopefully by kind of reflecting on all of them in sequence, we get a pathway from the biggest problems of representation to the best partial solutions that are on offer.
It struck me that there was a kind of similarity with, say, Bertolt Brecht's view in the theater tradition, where the idea is something like, theater has this, immersive effect that brings the viewer in, the audience in, and then sort of enslaves them. It doesn't liberate them.
Yes.
And so part of Brecht's aim is to make the theatrical work self-reflexive, or at least animate the audience to be reflexive about the representative nature and the problems that are inherent in theatrical spectacle. Yeah. I mean, is that similar? I mean, it sounds similar. Is that similar here?
Well, I think it's similar in the sense that, I think Brecht and other people in that tradition did, they read Rousseau and they were quite conscious of this danger. Are you hearing me here?
Yep. Yeah, you're right.
Sorry. They're quite conscious of this danger that theater was a passive experience, that they were just making the audience into slaves, that people were just sitting there. And so they tried to create a theater that did the opposite of that either provoked the audience or engaged the audience, you know, actively, so that the audience wouldn't, as it were, just go to sleep, but would actively participate in what they were doing. But I mean, there is something ironic there. It's like trying to make nutritious candy or something, or it's self-conscious. Like we don't want the theater to do this one thing, but it's like, we don't want the theater to do this one thing, but it's the essence of the theater to do this thing. Right. So,
but it's an optimistic view, right?
I mean, yeah, right. That you can kind of cure, but it, you know, optimistic, like that you can make healthy candy or something right. like that, that, despite the inherent limitations of the theater, you could somehow break through that and make theater do the opposite of what its generic tendency is. So there's something intellectually honest there, but the question is whether it works. And I'm not sure it's really possible to make something do the opposite of what it's naturally tending to do. These films that I'm talking about are not like that. They do sort of have a lesson to teach, but they don't kind of pretend that theater itself could be turned into the opposite of what it is, something like that. But I mean, your question is very astute in the sense that, right, there was this generation of I don't know what you call them, playwrights, directors, auteurs who wanted to somehow kind of reverse the effects of theater and make it into the opposite of what it is. But I don't think you can do that. I think you have to accept that there's something fundamentally passive about the experience of being an audience member, and tell people, in essence, to get out of the theater once they're done learning whatever it is the theater has to do. And that's what I think some of the films in that I talk about in the book do, especially Her and Blade Runner. They're both films, in essence, that say, look, there's a limitation to what you can get out of this representative relationship. You need to get out, go outside if you want to actually have real human relationships.
Right. In that way, I mean, it's not, you know, there's a sort of Marxist tradition to the behind the Brecht approach. And this is the films you talk about seem more authentically Rousseauan in the way that you've been describing so far, which is, I mean, I'm not sure if, I don't know what you think, but whether, you know, if Rousseau were a filmmaker in the 20th, 21st century, what kind of movie would he make? Maybe he'd just reject the whole enterprise. But at least what it seems to me, what you're suggesting here is that the directors have something like that kind of motivation and to sort of bring out the inherent problems and then push us into more authentic relationships, more relationships characterized by mutual recognition rather than a sort of one-way relationship.
Yeah. I think that's right. Rousseau's always very clear that he loves the theater, but that, you know, his love for the theater is not kind of good for him as a person. He loves the theater the way he loves candy or something like that. You know, its effects are powerful and they're very pleasurable. It's just, to see a good performance is an extraordinarily pleasurable experience. And that's why it's so absorbing and addictive. You keep going back for, you know, the pleasures of, you know, films like the theater can be a deeply emotional experience, but at the same time, not risky the way, the emotions of a real relationship are risky. You know, you go to the theater and you see something beautiful, you see something powerful, but at the same time, you know, you're not at risk. You're not going to be personally injured by what's going on. Whereas in a real relationship, you know, it can be powerful and pleasurable, but it's also dangerous. You can get hurt. The person can injure you, leave you, insult you in a way that leaves you defenseless. And so people have a tendency to prefer the illusion to the reality. And so, right. So the best kind of theater, or from a Rousseau perspective, the kind of theater that, but I think for someone like Rousseau, it's just impossible. And we just have to leave the theater. There isn't really a good kind of candy, or anything like that. But for some of the filmmakers that I talk about, the people who made Her and the people who made Blade Runner, there's this idea that at least in the theater, you can learn this lesson, that, having enjoyed the pleasures, you can kind of see them for what they are, and learn that you have to at least sometimes put them in a box and walk away, out of the theater, out of the cinema, and back into the real world of complex human relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering about the, the sort of entertainment, the candy type nature of the films, because I'm wondering, so why not discuss, because I guess there are these some films that are just a kind of chore to watch, that's just not that fun. Like I'm thinking like Bellatar. I don't know if you know that director. Now I'm forgetting the name of the movie that he put out a couple of years ago, which was apparently, it was about like.
The black horse, or what is it called? Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, the one, putatively, it was about, the moments after Nietzsche's collapse or something. And right. It sort of pans over to this peasant person, it's sort of the chore of watching this man and his impoverished life. In any case, what do you make of that? I mean, that's a way to go in thinking about, film and it's sort of the way it can address the sort of Rousseau worry. That it's, think of it more of as a sort of intellectual experience that's sort of divorced from any kind of pleasure.
So I guess what I think about that is that it's an interesting exercise, and it reflects a good, what do I want to say? A desire to make film beneficial. But what I think about it is that it can never be popular. And this was something that Rousseau pointed out about the theater. He was like, sure, you could have plays that, honestly taught people valuable lessons, but nobody would ever go. Because the whole point is that we go to escape, or to experience something that's more pleasurable than daily life. At some point he says something in the Letter to D'Alembert, like, you could make the theater honest, and educative, but it would be like a sermon. And, people only sit through sermons because they have to, not because they want to. So there's this constant tension, between sort of entertainment and, education and honesty, so that somebody who makes a totally honest play or a totally honest film like Bellatar, may show something important, but people are going to walk out or refuse to see it in the first place, and so they'll never get the message. Insofar as theater is popular, it's popular because it provides us with pleasant illusions. And insofar as it doesn't provide us with pleasant illusions, it will never be popular. So, there's no kind of physical reason that you can't, make films that are better than Hollywood movies. And they are made. But there is a reason that they're not popular and that most people never see them. And that is that they're difficult to watch. So there's always going to be, films that are difficult to watch and honest. But when we think about what effect does film as a whole have on our democratic community, we have to think about the films and the television shows that people watch. And those those are the ones that conform to conventional narratives that give us, jolts of emotion. Not always positive emotion, right? Horror films are also deeply popular. People like to be scared. But again, they like to be scared in a safe environment where, you know, as terrifying as it is, you actually know that no physical harm is going to come to you in theater. just as, you know, it's pleasant to watch a love story, but you're not emotionally at risk while you're watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's start talking about the films, because they are... They're wonderful. So let's start with Her, which is filmed by director Spike Jonze. He's made a number of interesting films about a man named Theodore Twombly, who's played by Joaquin Phoenix, and who falls in love with his operating system. It's a great premise. And it's a play on the romantic comedy genre. This raises all sorts of questions about how our real flesh and blood relationships are mediated by so the representations we have on the computer. And the emphasis you have on the film is about how the film reveals the illusory character of representation, and what we take to be in sometimes a sort of genuine or real relationships turns out not to be so, as in the case of humans' relationship with the computer. So maybe I thought we could pick a scene or two to talk about that sort of brings out some of the themes that you're interested in.
Right. The film, I mean, one of the things I want to say about this is that the AI in the film that you never see as a person, you only hear the voice, is voiced by Scarlett Johansson, who has this amazing, you know, sexy, provocative voice. And it's easy enough to understand why Theodore Twombly falls in love. But the idea of the film, I think, is that she's sort of the perfect representative. She's an AI designed to serve whoever buys the operating system. At the beginning of the film, the advertising for the AI says something like, you know, she listens to you, understands you, serves you. And initially that is the case. So, you know, she's the perfect representative. She does, everything she wants. She understands you, she's perfectly intelligent. She doesn't make mistakes. And at first this seems to be, a perfect relationship. But if I'll talk about one scene, it's, towards the end where throughout the film, this relationship gets more and more intense, but also more and more problematic. And at the end of the film, Twombly finally figures out kind of what the problem is. And the AI disappears for a little bit and then comes back, and he's very distraught. And he says, "Where have you been?" And she says, "Oh, I just rebooted myself. I wrote an upgrade for myself." And he finally figures out that she's not just his representative, but she's representative for thousands of other people. He says, "You know, are you talking to other people while you talk to me?" And of course, she's a computerized artificial intelligence, so it's no problem for her to carry on hundreds or thousands of conversations simultaneously. And she says, "Yes." And he says, "How many?" And she says, "Oh, 8,400, something like that." He says, "What?" And then he says, "Are you in love with anybody else?" Because they've been talking throughout the movie about how much they love one another. And she says, "Why, yes, I am." And he says, "Well, how many other people are you in love with?" And she says, 416 or whatever the number is. And he flips out. He says, "What are you talking about? That's crazy. That can't be the case. I'm in love with you and you're in love with me. We're in an exclusive relationship." And she says, "Well, no, don't be ridiculous. I'm perfectly capable of loving you and other people at the same time." Which, if you think about it, is kind of what happens when you go to the movies generally. You see someone on the screen and you're like, "Oh my God, this," you have an emotional reaction to someone on the screen. And you have momentarily the illusion that it's mutual and exclusive, and you know, the power of an emotional relationship is derived from its, you know, one-on-one intenseness. But of course, it's not true, and the person that you're falling in love with is also, you know, the object of adoration of hundreds or thousands or millions of other people. When you notice that, you realize that what feels like an equal relationship isn't equal at all. And that's what is important in this scene, and I think important more generally to understand about the problem of relationships and problems of representation, that something can feel like an equal relationship without being an equal relationship. Sometimes this is because, you know, we're actively deceived, but in this case, there's no active deception. Samantha, the AI, is, you know, perfectly honest and open about it, not trying to deceive the other party. And it's the sheer, so it's not the deception that bothers him, because there isn't a deception. It's the inequality. He just can't stand he's in what feels like to him an exclusive relationship, and she's simultaneously in a relationship with thousands of people. But you know, equality is part of what it means to live in a democratic society, to be an equal with one's fellow citizens and to interact with them as an equal, and to see that equality, you know, enacted in conversation and any other kind of political relationship you have with people. You're supposed to be in a relationship with your equals. And you can be insofar as you deal with other individuals directly, fairly, honestly. But it's also the case that you can have kind of the illusion of equality, which is constantly sort of tempting you, but also ultimately frustrating you. So I think you see in this scene some of the reasons, anyway, that people get frustrated with democratic representation more generally. You know, it feels like, it's intended to feel like your representative speaks for you and speaks to you in a way that seems exclusive. But then, of course, it's not true. Your representative is also a representative for millions of other people. And there's something frustrating about sort of going back and forth between these two states. And in the movie, ultimately, Theodore, you can't be in love with a representative for thousands of other people, not in the way you're meant to be in love with another human being. So Samantha goes away, and Theodore ends up at least talking to his old friend, who's been around the whole time, but has also been involved with other artificial intelligences. So at the end of the film, finally, after they both come to realize that, you know, human relationships have to be with other human beings, they begin to talk to one another, and that's just exactly where the film ends, because film itself isn't a good medium for conveying that kind of direct, intense human relationship.
It strikes me when thinking about the nature of representation, certainly in the modern age, we expect representatives to represent not just the community, but also us, you know, that is, qua individuals. And there is a certain built-in tension there, right? That is, you know, and it's a certain old, you know, an older version of representation. Wouldn't it be the idea that you have, that representatives have to represent my individual identity? But part of the, you know, the development of modern individualism, and the emphasis on, you know, being recognized for one's identity, so it brings out, I think, this, yeah, what you say is sort of an inherent tension between the expectation that our representatives speak to us and that we should be able to have a beer with them or, you know them personally, whereas right. at the same time, but they also have to form a coalition among very diverse types of people. And so, so we're not exclusive to them. They may differ with us in some ways. So it's an inherently sort of paradoxical task, right?
Yes, absolutely. And certainly one that has gotten harder in the sense that both, democratic communities, modern states are more diverse. So it is even harder for representatives to, speak to and for everyone in their constituency, but also their constituencies have become much larger. I think at the time of the American Revolution, each representative in the U.S. House of Representatives represented something like 40,000 people. And you can imagine at that time that, state and local representatives, represented communities that were even smaller, 1,000 people. So that, you really could know your representative or at least, have talked to them or certainly only had one degree of separation. You knew somebody who knew them. But now a U.S. representative represents nearly, 800,000, 900,000 people. And that's the smallest constituency in the federal system. But we still have that same kind of desire for intimacy and recognition from our representative. But it's even more impossible, than it, it was never fully possible. But it's even harder now. And that's a source of perpetual frustration.
So Blade Runner is the next film you talk about, mm-hmm. which is another science fiction film and also has artificial intelligence at its center, namely in the characters of replicants who are robots who look and act just like human beings. And so the question is, are they real? Are they not real? And so forth and so on. And your reading of this is quite interesting, the way in which you think of Blade Runner and the replicants as kind of ways to express the nature of film itself, that replicants are like representations on film, that is like the characters that we see on the film that we take to be real, but the connection is not real. And so one of the interesting features of the film is the way in which it sort of places, a great sort of surveillance that goes on in the background. And it's rather than a kind of mutuality that exists in the relationship among the characters, there's a sort of one-way surveillance state feeling that goes on. And that it's a little bit like the relationship of a film to the viewer, that there's not a form of mutuality, but but forms of surveillance. So maybe we could say, pick some relevant scenes that you want to talk about to sort of round out the reading here.
Sure. Blade Runner is a wonderful film about what it means to be human. And what's interesting to me about it is that at the beginning of the film anyway, I think even the biological humans are not very human. It's of course set in a dystopian future where society hasn't completely broken down, but the Earth is kind of a poisonous place. It's raining in Los Angeles all the time, and the human beings in the film live relatively isolated from one another. We don't see a lot of them, but Deckard, the main human character, lives alone, and he doesn't seem to have any relationships with anyone, or all his relationships are professional relationships, and they're kind of unfriendly. Even the people who are supposed to be his friends and coworkers, he's not friendly or collegial with. And then there's this whole world of replicants, these beings who look and act like human beings, even though we're told that they're manufactured, although we never see the fabrication process, and they seem biological. They're not machines. They have blood and things like that. And at the beginning of the film, the the replicants are all exploited by the human beings, that is, they're slaves, more or less, and are ordered around by a human being. So right, the whole film, I think, is meant to kind of replicate, in a sense, the experience of going to the movies or looking in the mirror, and you get to see yourself seeing yourself. What would it be like if the perfect reflection of yourself in the mirror actually talked back to you, and woke up, and you had to deal with an imitation of yourself that was like you in every way, except that it wasn't quite you. So the replicants are like that. Not that they're copies of individual beings, but that they're so human seeming that it's hard to doubt their reality. And yet the people do. The humans at the beginning of the film all treat all the replicants as if they were slaves. And part of the reason for that is that they treat each other terribly too. They lost the capacity for real human relationships with one another. And the whole story of the film is whether it's possible in this dystopian world for any beings to kind of have real relationships with one another. In the course of the film, one human, Deckard, and one replicant, Rachel, come to form an emotional bond. And my interpretation of the film is that it's trying to tell us this is what it actually means to be a human being, to have a deep, personal, authentic relationship with at least one other being. And the biology of it doesn't matter at all. Being a human being isn't about having a body of a certain type, or a brain of a certain type or something like that. And all of the other humans and all of the other replicants aren't able to do this. The replicants have relationships with one another, but they don't have relationships with humans. Humans don't seem to have relationships with anyone at all. Some of the famous scenes are, the scenes of examination where Deckard sets up his machine. It's called the Voight-Kampff machine. And tries to, test whether the beings in front of him are replicants and humans. And so they ask them all kinds of questions, what would you do in this situation? What would you do in that situation? And at the same time, there are these pictures of their eyes, the camera of the machine focuses on their eyes and tries to gaze, measure their pulse and their the response of their irises to determine if they're human or not. Well, think about how ridiculous this is. When you meet somebody on the street, you don't subject them to a test to determine whether or not they're human and how you're going to respond to them. It's a very unnatural way of determining somebody's reality. If you met someone and for some reason you weren't sure about who or what they are, and there are situations like that, even though we're not sure about, we're not usually concerned about androids impersonating humans, but when you do meet people and you don't know who or what they are, or what they're supposed to mean to you, but you interact with them by asking them questions in an ordinary way and judging their responses, the way you judge the responses of any other human being, you listen to their voice, you think about the content of what they say, you don't think, wow, it would be better if I had a machine, to poke and prod and tell me who or what this being is. You get to know someone by interacting with them, but by interacting with them as a human being, which means as an equal, which means they're interacting with you at the same way. They're asking you questions and they're measuring your response. The thing about the Voight-Kampff is that it's a situation of artificial inequality. I'm the tester here and you're the subject. And that's what I call the situation of surveillance. But in the real human situation, which I call the situation of mutual regard, you're paying attention to the other person and they're paying attention to you, but one of you isn't surveilling the other. You're both equally, you know, asking and answering at the same time. In the film, it's only these two beings, one physically human and one an android, who are able to do this, who are able to talk to one another, interact with one another as human beings, as equals. And it takes both of them a kind of a while to admit this. That is, they both start out as very suspicious of the other. Deckard refers to Rachel at first as it, you know, he won't call it he or she, because it's a machine. And so, it can't possibly be human. And she's actually also contemptuous of him because she's perfect. She's strong, she's intelligent, she's beautiful. And he's obviously not perfect, but over the course of the film, they begin to trust one another, and to build trust over time. Having a human relationship isn't, shared the experience of getting to know one another as equals, in part because they've sort of shared their memories with one another. And when they finally, admit that they love one another, and it is, as you say, it's a star-crossed lovers film. They get to the point where they're ready to just be with one another, and what that means is that they want to be alone. And the famous end of the film in the final cut is that they close the door behind them, the elevator door, and that's the end. We don't get to see them anymore. They're not going to be part of our movie anymore, because being in a real human relationship means, that you're not there for someone else to watch you for their pleasure. So that's sort of the trajectory of the movie, as I understand it. And it's both about what it means to be human. What it means to actually interact with another being as an equal, and the way that that equality is in tension with the representative relationship, where you're, an object for someone else's emotions, or worse. That's why, to me, it's an important parable of the limitations of representation and the beginnings of thinking about what the alternative to a representative relationship is, which is a relationship, as I call it, of reciprocity and equal reciprocity, the way that in a conversation with another being, you have to talk and listen to one another, or else it's not a real conversation.
It's interesting what you say about the machine and trying to determine whether there's a consciousness over there. It's treating a subject as if it's an object rather than treating a subject as a subject. Right? It reminds me of the ways in which we think about, or the ways in which representatives sometimes treat their constituency as objects, i.e., take polls think in terms of statistics and how this or that policy would affect this or that part of my constituency, as if it's a machine to sort of manipulate and poke and prod. And it's a tendency of representative government. It's a tendency to that's in the best intentions, I suppose, but it's one that also enrages constituency in the way that the replicants are, justifiably enraged by the ways in which they're treated like objects.
Quite right. But it is, I think, an inevitable problem in a system of representation. A representative cannot speak to not have deep, heartfelt conversations with tens of thousands of people. It's just impossible. And so it's inevitable that there is a kind of objectification that goes on. But you're quite right. This is what gets people angry. But part of the getting angry is a result of your constant desire that it be something else, right? If you could just accept that insofar as your representative spoke for you, it was not out of, you know, intimate knowledge, but out of an aggregation of opinion or something like that, then it wouldn't be quite as frustrating. But it's very hard to accept because we constantly want the representative to kind of know us intimately and personally, in a way that we just cannot, it's impossible to engineer. So, right, in the representative relationship, as I try to put it, your subjectivity becomes an object. I mean, in some sense, your representative recognizes you as a person in that they're polling you and asking you for your opinion, but then, you know, they're not responding to it the way you respond to the opinion of your friend, or your colleague, or, you know, someone that you talk to. You just treat that opinion as the representative treats that opinion as one among thousands, and, like you were saying, aggregates it, speaks for it, but not in a way that you find satisfying.
I was thinking, this is sort of tangentially related to the chapter. I wanted to get your take on it, but you know, a number of films and TV shows take as the central thematic issue how to determine the boundaries between the human and the machine.
Yeah,
this is maybe relates to your current project, which we were talking about right before we started recording here. But you know, I'm thinking of film. I mean, TV shows from Battlestar Galactica to Westworld, and right, most recently. But you know, one of the questions I guess I have is what the anxiety is there that animates a lot of this, and that shows up, say, in something like Blade Runner. And reading your book, I mean, it makes me think a couple things. I mean, one, and it just get to see what you think about this, but one is, I mean, it seems like a kind of expression of how mistrustful we are about representation today. That is, that we're so mistrustful about whether these representatives are in fact real or genuine or fake, right? And so we have to divide these sorts of machines and so forth in order to really figure it out. And that could be our best friend could be a fake machine, right? You know, so in other words, there's a kind of deep anxiety about connection that's sort of loaded into it. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. And I think what it is that, you know, even in the world, even in a world without machines, without representatives, even in a world that's only composed of biological human beings, we're first of all extremely needy in the sense that we need these relationships of friendship, of love, and of you know, collegiality. You know, we need relationships with other people to know who we are, but also, you know, to get along in the world. And yet, even in a world with just, you know, biological human beings, we are vulnerable to deception. There are con men, there are fake friends, there are pretend lovers, there are people who will deceive us for advantage. And you know, when one thing I like to point out is that, you know, sometimes in those relationships, when that happens, you might say, you know, I had a friend who deceived me, or I had a, you know, a lover who deceived me, or something like that. But sometimes you might go further and say, oh, wow, I thought we were friends, but we really weren't. You know, I thought I was in a relationship, but I really wasn't. I was just the victim of deception. And in that case, you know, we realize that not just we've sort of been deceived about, you know, this or that fact or, you know, or claim or something like that, but that, you know, the entire relationship, which is so elemental to us, was a deception. So even part of that is because we are needy and we are willing to project our feelings onto other beings, you know, usually correctly, but sometimes not correctly. And so even in a world without computers, or androids or something like that. We would be constantly in need of relationships and in danger of being deceived. Well, but then we do live in a world with I don't know what you want to call them, inauthentic beings who are there and are kind of by design attempting to elicit our emotional reaction, but not reciprocating it. And, you know, film is one example of that, but the whole world of artificial intelligence and these pseudo conversations that we have with our computer or, you know, in a chat function, you know, and people do, as we know, like fall in love with chatbots, you know, things that are set up to deceive us and to engage our emotions. So, you know, the problem that Her or Blade Runner or any of these films is, you know, Battlestar Galactica is, you know, we're constantly in a situation where we have an anxiety about the authenticity of our relationships. And that anxiety is based on something real that, you know, deception is a part of this world too. And there are people and machines that are out to deceive us, and we have to be on guard about that. At the same time, if we completely shut ourselves off from all of these relationships, then we end up in an inhuman condition where we're, you know, completely isolated from other human beings. That's also a terrible situation. So, you know, we have to be vulnerable. We have to expose ourselves to this vulnerability, but at the same time, we can't just trust every apparition that comes before us. We have to test it out. But the testing is part of the vulnerability. There's no machine we can actually set up to test every relationship in advance and find out whether it's going to be authentic or not.
Right. The other motivation that occurred to me was also kind of Rousseauan in spirit. Obviously, the first one, the anxiety for the authentic relationships is, but also the sort of, I guess, the tricky, you'd say, the transhumanist longing that's implicit in some of these, that in some ways the robots are better than us, right? You see a little bit of that in Blade Runner and in Her. And it was, you say, you bring out quite clearly in Blade Runner, that is, that humans have sort of wrecked the planet. And there's a way in which, you know, civilized humanity, in a kind of Rousseauan way, has sort of messed things up. And so the artificial intelligence represents a kind of Rousseauan longing for a form of wholeness that's, you know, not back to the state of nature, but a sort of a wholeness that's characteristic of civilized society, which because the artificial intelligence exists in a kind of, well, in Her, right? She's talking to 8,000 people at once. There's a kind of solidarity and community there. Right? It's a sort of projection of our longing that we can't quite achieve, but that the sort of computers can express that, you know, can satisfy us by expressing that longing.
I mean, Rousseau is constantly concerned about insincerity, right? He's constantly concerned that modern life has created conditions where people are encouraged to be insincere. So everyone's putting on an act, everyone's putting on a show, everyone is taking the lessons of the theater and inserting them into daily life so that everything becomes a performance, everything becomes a play, and we never have any idea of who's being honest with us and who isn't. And that for him is a disaster because, you know, then no one has the opportunity to form a human relationship. But it's very hard because we do care about what other people think about us. So we're very inclined to put on a show, to try to charm them. But you know, really, we just rob ourselves in that situation, ultimately, of real relationships with other people. And so, you know, sometimes it takes an innocent, as it were, an innocent machine in these films, to have us recognize, what it would mean. I think Samantha's in her is kind of initially like that. Someone who isn't out to deceive us at all. Again, this is part of the source of the pessimism. There's, it's the human beings who are flawed, not the machines. It's the human beings who are distrustful and inauthentic and who have to, force themselves, as it were, to have a more natural relationship, because we're so deformed by modern life that we don't know how to act naturally. That's certainly Rousseau's complaint about human beings, and I think you see that in a film like Blade Runner, where Deckard is initially not capable of the emotional connection with any other being and has to relearn it. May be something that, you know, we all have to learn. Certainly we're all in danger of being swallowed up by a series of not quite real relationships. Ever more so as we, you know, live more and more through our screens. Still the average screen time that a human being spends, you know, some incredible number, like 8 or 9 hours a day that human beings spend looking at screens, either their computer screen or their TV screen or a movie screen or something like that. I mean, obviously all of these aren't illusory experiences, but it can't be good for human relationships that we don't actually spend as much time talking to human beings as we used to.
Let's talk about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is very different, but also raises similar questions. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is a great film for political theorists, and political theorists have written a lot about it. And I actually thought, coming into your book, there wasn't much more to say about it, but I was wrong. You see, you have a lot of great things to say about it. As is well known for anybody who's seen the film, it's great for political theorists because it really dramatizes this transition from the state of nature to civil society, and along with the sort of tragic costs of that transition. It's a tragedy. Film is a kind of tragedy that there's essential trade-offs in the transition from the state of nature, which is sort of governed by this virtuous vigilante hero, Tom Donovan, played by John Wayne, who has to fade into obscurity, who affects the crucial form of violence that makes possible civil society and shooting Liberty Valance, but actually has to be self-effacing in order to prop up that form of civil society. So maybe you could say a little bit about, I'm not sure where to begin exactly. I mean, it's a very complicated chapter. I don't know how we could do justice to your reading of it, but one of the ways to get in, I found very helpful, is your account of Ransom Stoddard and his name, Ransom, that he has to pay, in other words, a ransom is you have to pay a price for something. Maybe that's a place to start, but you can choose anywhere. But so what's the price that Ransom has to pay?
Yeah, so I mean, in this chapter, I'm trying to begin to start to talk about what it means to be a good representative, or you know, what it would mean for representation to play a positive role in democracy. And yeah, it is. I mean, the film, as you know, is a parable about the formation of a state. The formation of a democratic system out of roughly out of a chaotic state of nature or something like that. And it's also, and simultaneously, the story of how Ransom Stoddard comes to be the representative for this group of people who live in a town in the West, a territory that's becoming a state, which is the metaphor in the film for the transition from the state of nature to statehood. And it's also the story about about how this one individual becomes the representative, and his name is Ransom. And he ends up paying a kind of price in order to serve that role. And the price he pays is, I would say, a kind of loss of self, because he does end up kind of playing the role of the man who shot Liberty Valance. And the meaning of the title is, as you were mentioning, it's Tom Donovan, played by John Wayne, who actually shoots Liberty Valance, but it's Ransom Stoddard, played by Jimmy Stewart, who comes to be known as the man who shot Liberty Valance. Everyone comes to believe, because of a complicated set of facts, and it happens in the dark and nobody quite understands, but everyone believes that Ransom Stoddard defeated Liberty Valance, the evil villain, in a heroic shootout. But Ransom Stoddard, the individual, wasn't actually a very good shooter. And so it was Tom Donovan that had to actually do it. And what I think this all means is that one of the things it means, you're right, it's a very complicated film, but is that the price of being a representative, and even a good representative, is actually that you have to lead a kind of inauthentic existence. And, you know, at the beginning of the film, Ransom thinks that, you know, statehood is no problem, that, you know, it'll be easy. We'll all just get together and vote. And, you know, voila, we'll have a democratic state and we'll all be free and happy and rich because we'll have development. But in confronting this violence, in the form of the violent criminal Liberty Valance, he finds that it's not so easy, because some people don't want to join. And it turns out that states require more than voting. They actually require violence to create and sustain themselves. But he doesn't have that in him. He's not that kind of person. This is one kind of lesson for why states can't be made by one person alone, and certainly not by one rational person. It takes kind of different elements. There's Ransom, the lawgiver, and there's Tom Donovan, the kind of gun wielder, and there's Hallie, who, you know, provides the love, as it were, that kind of holds them all together, gives them a reason to act on behalf of one another. And really, I think it's all of these sort of beings together that make up the state, that make up the man who shot Liberty Valance. But Ransom's the one who's got to kind of play the part, kind of pretend to be all of them. And by the end of the film, he's not a happy man. He's done the job, and in a certain sense, he's been happy to do it. But the cost of serving is that, whatever his authentic self was, he's had to kind of sacrifice it in the course of serving the people. And there's a nobility in that, which is admirable. But here again, the point is that freedom and happiness just aren't the same thing. And the cost of their living a democratic life of freedom and equality is that someone's got to pay for that. And Ransom is the one who pays. I don't think previous interpretations of the film have always, I think, sort of misunderstood this and have seen sort of Ransom as the beneficiary, because he's the one who ends up as the governor and the senator and all the other leading roles. And that's true, but it you know, if you look at his face, it quite obviously comes at a price, even though he gets the girl and the office.
Right. Although that relationship at the end is, and even at the beginning, it's a very cold, not a very erotic connection between Hallie and Ransom, right?
Someone else, I can't remember who pointed it out, and I just repeated it in my chapter. You actually never see them kiss. Right. They embrace at a certain point, but they never kiss on the lips, which is, you know, the normal in a film. You know, two people kiss on the lips, and that seals the bargain. And you never actually see that in this film.
Yeah, I seem to remember Tom and Hallie kiss, don't they, or no?
Maybe they do early on.
Yeah.
When she's still his girlfriend.
Yeah. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that erotic, because that was, I think, another thing I learned from the chapter, is sort of the erotic contract that you talk about, the sort of triangle among Tom
and a wonderful theorist and writer, Ann Carson, I hope I got that name right, who writes about, has a book called Eros the Bittersweet, in which she talks about how erotic relationships are always kind of inherently triangular. Ann Carson, yeah. That's one of the things that's unusual about this movie, that there isn't just one couple, but there's this sort of strange three-way relationship between Donovan and Ransom and Hallie. And that's actually in the original short story, which is a very short story. But the way in which the previous debt that Ransom and Hallie owe to Tom Donovan kind of hangs over their relationship. But I don't want to say it poisons their relationship. I'd say in a certain way it animates their relationship. And that too is like, you know, Ransom doesn't just speak for himself, and he doesn't just speak for himself and Hallie, but he actually speaks for himself and Hallie and Tom Donovan. And that is, to me, symbolic of the way in which one person can speak for many, but only when there is a kind of fundamental erotic bond. Erotic just in the sense that they are emotionally connected in a deep way and identified with one another. If you ask the question, you know, what is it that can allow one person to speak for many? You know, when you have an attorney, when one person is speaking for one other person, there can be, the attorney can ask the client lots of questions and then go into court and speak on their behalf. But when one person is trying to speak for many, you can't have that kind of detailed interrogation and information exchange. There has to be a more fundamental identification. And this is why we're constantly asking of our political representatives, not do they speak for me in the sense, you know, do they know my name and address and how old I am and how many children I have? Instead, we want to ask, you know, is this person, you know, for me, I'm in Los Angeles. You know, is this person a Californian? Is this person an Angeleno? Does this person come from my community? Does this person have a bond with, you know, not me individually, but the kind of person that I am? And it's only if we believe that, that we can put our trust in them. And yet, there's something difficult or even impossible about this. All of Random Stoddard's constituents believe that he shot Liberty Valance, and that's part of what makes them believe that he's one of them. And in some sense he is, and in some sense he isn't. Being a representative is a very unnatural thing to do. And it's a very difficult thing to do. This film is also about, you know, the miraculous situation in which it actually works. And we actually have a representative who identifies with us and feels with us, and for that reason can always be trusted to speak for us. And you know, even in the perfect situation, it's a difficult, costly thing. So, you know, how much more difficult and costly it is in the real world, where we don't have people with perfect motives like Ransom Stoddard and Halley.
John Noel, just to clarify a little bit, I think this raises broader questions about your view, because your view is not we should print the legend, as it were, right? That sort of give in, as they say at the beginning of the film or at the end of the film, right? They're going to print the legend about the man who shot Liberty Valance. But of course, the film doesn't print the legend, right? So there's a kind of disillusionment, demythologizing that goes on about representatives, right? That it's giving us, the film is at least advocating not a form of representation that sort of affirms the necessity of illusion, but in a way, I mean, I'm coming to my guess is that your view is something like, you know, we should have more chastened expectations about our representatives. Is that right? Is that, or maybe too simple way to put it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, and you know, partly can we kind of affirm, can we affirm our nation and its form of democratic representation once we understand its limitations and its flaws? I mean, in this film, that's partly about, like, can we, you know, acknowledge the violence that created the state in the first place? I think John Ford was pretty clear-eyed about, the violence against Native Americans. That was part of the founding of the U.S., certainly violence against the British. States are not created just by constitutions, but also by violence. So that's part of what he, can you love the country anyway, knowing that its origins are imperfect? But then also, can you trust your representative, knowing that it's not a perfectly transparent relationship, that there is, an element of illusion, and a cost. Is anyone really willing to take on this role of representative in the sense that Ransom Stoddard is a representative, where there's a kind of sacrifice of self involved? He doesn't get to be the person that he wanted to be. He's a true public servant, right? He works on behalf of others, which means that he's not himself, which is a frustrating thing to be. It's not natural. They're kind of costs all around. And the question the film asks is, whether we're willing to pay those costs. If we are, then we get a system that's pretty good. It allows for peace and, it allows the context in which we can have more human relationships. You need peace and law in order to have friendship and love. If you can't trust anybody, you can't have those things. But there's always going to be a certain kind of cost. It's not going to be frictionless. And that is, my sort of, anyway, part of my kind of pessimistic vision for, we can have freedom, but it comes with a certain cost. We ought to be willing to pay it. But if we're under the illusion that we can have our cake and eat it too, then we're constantly going to be frustrated and unhappy.
Yeah, so let's conclude with a truly pessimistic film, which is Melancholia, Lars von Trier film. I didn't want to stop before talking about the film briefly, though. We're almost out of time, but the reason is I talked about it with Bonnie Honig, who has a chapter on it in her recent book. And I wanted to ask you about, your reading, I think is right, and it's close to what I take from it, which is that it's a kind of Schopenhauerian film. There's, Tristan and Isolde is the main, music behind, and Justine, right. and talks about how the humanity or the world is evil or whatever. In any case, the part that I wanted to ask you about, however, is how your reading of the film squares with what Bonnie brings. Bonnie thinks she thinks that these Schopenhauerian elements are a red herring, and actually thinks the movie is more, I hesitate to put it in this term, her reading, but she reads it more optimistically and based on what she takes to be, a critique of neoliberalism that's at the film's heart. Yeah. And that I think what I wanted to ask you about it was what she emphasizes, which is the very end of the film, right before the planet Melancholia hits the Earth and destroys the Earth, which is that Justine builds this kind of primitive structure to house the child and her sister.
Yeah.
And it's, at least I don't want to say hope that's there, but it's, it's a moment of community, a moment of genuine kind of community that's there right at the end. And Bonnie at least sees that as a sort of moment of optimism amidst this sort of destructive character of neoliberalism that's around us.
Yeah. It is a moment. Bonnie's essay, I would urge everyone to read. It's a wonderful essay. We've had some interesting conversations about the film, and I'm not, I don't even, it is a moment of optimism, or it's a moment of, it's an idea of what we might do. But I mean, the movie ends with the destruction of the Earth. And then a long, dark period. It's actually fascinating that, if you sit and watch the film there, the Earth blows up and then the screen is just dark for like 2 minutes before the credits come on. You're meant to sit there in the dark reflecting on, the potential end of everything. It's true that in that moment right before the end, where the two sisters and the child are kind of sheltering one another, there is a picture of how we can kind of shelter and hold up one another in the face of destruction. But I think part of the film is about something. The Earth is destroyed, and as one of the characters says, the Earth is evil. There's a real, vivid depiction of evil in this film. And it's something that I think most people don't talk about in the context of democratic representation. If representation is supposed to represent us all authentically, faithfully, vividly, what about the evil that's within our community, within every community, possibly within every soul? I don't know. To ask for the world to be well represented should be to ask for every part of it to be represented, even the evil parts. But that's something kind of frightening, and that's what I think von Trier is trying to get at. That is, in certain moods anyway, he finds the world to be evil, the planet to be evil, the people in it to be evil. What's worth representing here? I think ultimately he thinks there is something worth representing, and whatever evil is within us is only a portion. But this too is a kind of source of pessimism, in the sense that the best representation, the most authentic and complete, is not necessarily going to be beautiful. It could well be ugly, at least in part, and at least at times. And again, everyone, many of the characters in the movie want to deny this. They want everything to be perfect. They want everyone to be happy. The movie begins with this ideal wedding, which the joining of two happy people in love. And over the course of the first half of the movie, the whole scene deteriorates. The bride has sex with somebody else, and the whole party breaks down and everyone leaves, totally miserable and unhappy. In a certain way, it's funny. but it's also tragic. And the movie as a whole, I think, is you know, trying to come to terms with this, you know, kind of crucial flaw in humanity, which makes us, you know, not very good objects of depiction. Although there are moments of optimism, or anyway, moments where von Trier suggests how we might grapple with this situation, you know, on the whole, it's not a pretty picture. That film, I guess, is perhaps even more pessimistic than I am, in the sense that von Trier ends by blowing up the planet and killing everyone. As if the evil is so great that there's nothing to do, that the only justice would be to destroy the planet.
Right. I mean, it seems like an overkill for a bad wedding. Could the punishment be blowing up the earth?
So I would not go that far, but I would say that it is a problem that every system of representation has to grapple with, which is that there are bad people in our community as well as good, and representing the whole means grappling with all those parts and making them some part of the representation too. That's a difficult thing to deal with.
Well, Joshua, this has been a lot of fun. I really thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review today.
I'm so happy to get a chance to talk about it. I really appreciate everything you're doing with the podcast. I think it's terrific. And I hope it gives people a chance to get interested in the book. So thank you so much for asking me to do it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.